This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. State environmental officials are notifying owners of private wells near Duke Energy's coal ash plants this week that they'll be getting new permanent water supplies or home filters by late 2018. WFAE's David Borax has more.
Letters went out this week to about 1,000 households within a half mile of most of Duke's coal ash storage ponds around the state. In June, lawmakers updated the state's coal ash management law to require that Duke provide alternate drinking water supplies. The law passed despite disagreements over whether the wells are safe. While tests have found some contamination, Duke Energy says its own tests show coal ash isn't the cause. And top state environmental officials say risks are minimal and that the state acted too quickly last year to tell people their wells weren't safe. Environmental Secretary Donald Vandervaart said 2 weeks ago, the new water supplies will give well owners long-term peace of mind.
We believe the wells are safe, but the Coal Ash Management Act looks at the closure of these coal ash ponds over the course of from now forever. And so as an added level of safety, because things can move, the plumes can move, we're going to hook these folks up with water, and then we're going to close these ponds.
Duke will pay to connect the homes to public water supplies. Of course, that means a new monthly expense for homeowners. If they prefer, Duke will install home water filtration systems. Duke must submit its plans to the state by December and complete the work by October 2018. I'm David Borax in Charlotte.
Duck stamps aren't for mailing a letter or package. They're actually used by hunters. People 16 years of age or older are required by state law to carry a duck stamp when hunting waterfowl. The North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission created the State Waterfowl Conservation Stamp and Print Program in 1983 to help preserve wetland habitat. But it's not just hunters that purchase the stamps. Art collectors appreciate the beauty and complexity of the images, showcasing local waterfowl depicted in their natural environment, sometimes including familiar landmarks. Now, the Washington Tourism Development Authority is asking artists to submit their works for the coveted and collectible NC Duck Stamp. Mac McKee speaks with Tourism Director Lynn Wingate about the competition.
What are the hallmarks of a great duck stamp, and what are some examples you've seen that stand out from others in the years you've worked with it?
Wow, I'm always glad when I see the artwork come in that I am not one of the judges, because we have seen some just amazing art. And as I mentioned, the artists are from across the country. So these are artists that have won waterfowl conservation stamp competitions in other areas. These are Ducks Unlimited artists. Probably one of the things that we see and appreciate so much with our stamp program is when notable spots in North Carolina are featured. The original work that won last year had one of North Carolina's lighthouses in the background. So it was a very fitting and appropriate work of art to be used and selected.
How long has the North Carolina Duck Stamp Competition itself been held?
Honestly, I do not know the answer to that. I know that the competition has been here in Washington for a little more than 10 years. Okay. So I do know that there's been a competition for at least 10 years.
How many artists usually submit work, Lynn?
We'll have anywhere between 30 and 40 artists that are sending us artwork from across the country.
Last year, Garrett Jacobs from Orlando, Florida, won with his acrylic painting of what's called an Atlantic Brant. Now, there are submissions from all over the country, like Pennsylvania, Texas, and Virginia. Which brings up a question, why aren't more North Carolina artists participating?
I would assume that it's because waterfowl artists are in a genre of their own, particularly when you are talking about a stamp program like this. You have to consider the fine amount of detail that it's going to transfer from, you know, a 16-inch painting into a 2-inch or smaller stamp. So I think with waterfowl, there is a different niche there, and there are a lot of artists who perhaps are intimidated by that.
Now, for this year's competition, artists may submit realistic renderings of tundra swans, blue-winged teal, ringneck duck, gadwall, and bufflehead. Now, are these waterfowl commonly found here in eastern North Carolina?
Yes, they are. And they are selected by the Wildlife Resources Commission. And not only are they selecting species that are found here, it is noted the type of habitat where these ducks would be found in North Carolina. If they were found in another state, they could perhaps the habitat could be a little different.
A lot of these different types of birds and ducks being found around the Lake Matamuskeet area?
Oh, certainly. You will definitely find them. I know, having birthed a duck hunter myself, I know that there are quite a few of these that we can find right here in eastern North Carolina.
Now, for the competition, what types of medium are you accepting?
We will take oils, acrylics, watercolors. Last year we had someone that did pen and ink. So we have had all different types, but it seems to be that the oils and acrylics are the most popular ones, I guess because of detail.
Now, there's a panel of five judges made up of artists and waterfowl experts. Can you tell me more about the judges and what kind of criteria they use?
Right. We do work with the Wildlife Commission to identify who suitable judges are. We'll have biologists. We will have birding enthusiasts. And the panel does change from year to year. So we do look for different criteria to try and meet people that are actually looking at the birds and are knowledgeable at what they're looking at rather than just looking at a pretty piece of art.
How much money, Lynn, is generated through the sale of these prints and stamps, and what kind of things did the money go to fund?
The money that is generated by the sale of the stamp and particularly the print goes to help with the goals to restore waterfowl populations. The Wildlife Commission has used it for developing new habitats, for research, for all different types of conservation efforts.
Lynn, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Well, thank you very much. You have a wonderful day.
Entries must be submitted by 5 p.m. on January 20th. Judging will take place January 24th, and the winner will be notified shortly after. For more information on the NC Duck Stamp Competition, go to publicradioeast.org.
After a tropical storm or hurricane, you can always count on clear skies. That makes this Sunday a perfect time to grab a blanket and gaze up at the Carolina skies.
This is Byron Mumaugh from the Carolina Skies Astronomy Club. This summer has been a very good time to observe the planets. First, recall that the word planet is derived from the ancient Greek word for wanderer. The Greek observers noted that all stars remained in the same position relative to each other, with only five exceptions. Those five objects, which looked like bright stars, would wander among the other stars. Thus, they named them planets, or wanderers. We know these as Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The best time to observe this movement of the planets is when they pass in front of a familiar constellation. That is happening now with planets Mars and Saturn passing constellation Scorpius. So, if you'd like to impress your children or grandchildren with your knowledge of astronomy, here's what to do. First, look at a picture or star chart of Scorpius to become familiar with its shape. Then on a clear night, just after it gets dark, find it in the sky. The best time in early September is between 9 and 10 p.m. Look to the south-southwest horizon. Scorpius normally looks like a string of average bright stars with one much brighter star in it. That bright star is the red giant Antares. But now something looks much different about Scorpius. Instead of one bright star, there are three bright objects. That is because Mars and Saturn are now above Antares. On the nights of 23 and 24 August, all three objects formed a straight line with Antares on the bottom, much brighter Mars above it, and Saturn above Mars. With three bright objects in a line, it makes it easy to spot and identify them without a telescope or binoculars. Each night after 24 August, Mars rapidly moved much further to the east, i.e., to your left, while Saturn moves much more slowly to the east. By the middle of September, Mars will be out of Scorpius and halfway to the constellation Sagittarius. But Saturn will still be in front of Scorpius, just a little farther to the left than it had been in August. So if you go down clear nights each week from now through October, you can really notice the movement of the planets against the background stars. This is also an excellent time to observe Mars and Saturn through a telescope. If you don't have a telescope, look up your local astronomy club. Our next Carolina Skies Star Party, open to the public, is September 24th at 7:30 p.m. Amateur astronomers are always happy to share the view through their telescopes. Until next time, I wish you clear skies.
Well, I love starting my morning with Morning Edition. So I love the news program. But at night sometimes, as I'm cooking dinner, I like listening to the sound. I have many CDs I acquired after hearing Groot for the first time on the sound. And last but not least, of course, Down East Journal, because Down East Journal really influences the things I want to do on weekends here in Eastern North Carolina. By listening to the journal, I can plan my weekends and really tap into some of the exciting and rich culture we have here. Public Radio East gives back to me 10 times more than I could ever pay in dollars and cents. And I would encourage everybody to make that investment, because the return is much better than investing your money in the stock market or anything else. I'm Janet Mullaney, and I am Public Radio East.
Asheville's The Broadcast is doing what they do so often, incessantly touring, this time in support of their latest CD, From the Horizon. Traveling is a way of life for this band, down to their decision to what they thought they needed to do to achieve success, though their path took them on a road less traveled in an effort to establish that career. George Olson spoke with the band's lead singer, Caitlin Crisco, on the release of their first full CD back in 2013, and has this.
I've long jokingly said that I'm still deciding what it is I want to be when I grow up. At 50 plus, the joke is getting old, as am I for that matter. Still, there's some truth behind the joke, which may be why I've always had a deep respect for anyone who determines what it is they want to be and pursue it doggedly with no doubt, no regrets. Among those now with my deep respect, Caitlin Crisco and her bandmates in the band, The Broadcast.
And being in New York City, we realized, financially speaking, it really wasn't attainable to do that. We couldn't afford to pay our rent there and be on the road 150 days a year without, you know, spraining our back trying to get people to sublet our apartments and finding odd jobs in the city when we were actually in town. It was just really stressful to us. And then on a personal level, just growing up in New York, I had never really left home before after college, you know? And I just realized that I needed a new experience. And I think a lot of us realized we needed a new experience in order to be inspired creatively.
So the band packed up the van and moved to Asheville, with everyone moving into the same house so they could keep expenses down as they try to follow a path they felt had been blazed by those who had musical success before them.
And so we started looking at the careers of bands that we loved. And when we were looking at the history of music, we noticed a pattern. And that pattern was, no matter what generation or decade it was, a lot of the greatest bands came from touring and literally sacrificing their lives to be able to tour full-time, bringing music similarly to a circus or a gypsy act. You go city to city, town to town, and you introduce your creative work to the people and hope that they respond to it. And I don't wanna break.
There's an expression, how are you going to keep them on the farm once they've seen the bright lights of the big city? To some degree, Caitlin Crisco and The Broadcast had the bright lights, opted for the farm. They chose to take the road traveled most, just in reverse. Caitlin also got some against-the-grain advice while receiving training at Circle in the Square, a respected New York theater art school, that prodded her to consider a different path.
I had always intended on pursuing musical theater in my life, and had always planned on going the Broadway route. And I had a great music theory teacher in college, Marianne Ivan, who I'll always call out in interviews because she was such a pivotal moment for me. And she just planted a seed after my freshman year of college and said, you know, I think that you should be a rock star instead of a musical theater geek. And no one had ever told me that before. It was this aha moment that totally changed the direction of my life. There is a place into the start. Eats you alive, tears you apart. And it tears you apart. I know it's gonna tear you apart. Because it tears me apart.
The rest of the members of the broadcast may have gotten similar advice in the past. In scanning biographies of the band's members, it seemed I came upon the word conservatory pretty regularly, to the point I half wondered if the broadcast was the revenge of the music room nerds. Caitlin didn't disagree.
With Michael Davis, our drummer, he was one of the star performer drummers at Manhattan School of Music. I mean, he's one of the best jazz drummers I've ever heard in my life. He's got a great side project, a trio called Enormous Trio, that is mind-boggling. And he's the go-to jazz drummer in Asheville now. And it's really funny that his passion project and his real focus is this rock and roll band that we've created. I think that there's just nothing quite like the energy that the broadcast shows bring to all of us. You know, we all do sort of side projects here and there just for fun. And we always come back to the broadcast because it's a workhorse. Hey, are you gonna waste it? Are you gonna go and throw this all away? Hey, I don't wanna waste it. I don't wanna wake up and find that you didn't say. Hey, I don't wanna waste it. I don't wanna go and throw this all away. Hey, are you gonna waste it? Don't waste it, don't you waste it, no.
The virtuosity that might come from a conservatory education isn't immediately obvious in the broadcast new CD, Dodge the Arrow. It's well performed, but there's not a lot of what I've always termed give the drummer some moments. Extended instrumental breaks that seem to say more about the performer's skill than its fit with the song. And that was the idea on Dodge the Arrow. Much as they emulated the road warrior-ness of bands they admired, they also wanted to model what they heard on their recordings.
And when we listened to records that we loved, and when we all started listing albums that meant a lot to us personally, they were pretty cut and dry records. You know, you listen to Led Zeppelin 4. I mean, it's a rock record, but there's not a whole lot of jamming. And if you listen to the Beatles, Abbey Road, or really any of the Beatles, there's really not a whole lot of jamming going on. And these records mean a lot to us, and we started to see a common thread. And we just didn't want to be long-winded with this record. I wanted to get to the point.
And they do. Dodge the Arrow is brevity defined. 8 songs running about 30 minutes. It's a paean to getting to the point and a realization of the times the broadcast is trying to survive in.
Let's be serious. People have very short attention spans now. And we can argue that and we can say it's not true and we can ignore it. Or we can embrace it and we can learn how to work with it. And we can learn how to get people's attention enough in a way where they don't suddenly start skipping songs in the record. You know what I mean? I wanted people to turn on Dodge the Arrow and on the last note of the last song, get upset about the fact that the record's over and want to turn it back on again.
Or better yet, go see a show. There's plenty of opportunity to do that. The band is constantly traveling, with Caitlin estimating since their move to Asheville in 2010, they average around 150 shows a year. The band is all in, from that commitment to touring whenever and wherever to sharing living space, a decision Caitlin says has proven magical and which she expects to reminisce on fondly in later years. They're all in another way as well. In the band's New York incarnation, they were Caitlin Crisco and the broadcast, Caitlin the headliner, the broadcast backing her up. Today, no more.
It was actually my suggestion to drop my name from the title. It was important to me to show unification. We're a family, and every single person in this band has sacrificed an enormous amount in their life to be able to pursue this as a career. And I thought that it was really important that each person was represented in the title of what we were setting out to do.
Again, all in.
Dodge the arrow as it's leaving from your bow.
The new CD from Asheville's The Broadcast is entitled Dodge the Arrow. I'm George Olson.
die.
Next Thursday, September 8th, the End of Life Care Coalition of Eastern Carolina will hold their film series in Greenville. The film explores the relationships doctors have with patients who are nearing end of life.
My name is Susan Redding. I'm president of the End of Life Care Coalition. The film that we're going to be showing was actually shown back in 2015 on Frontline. The name of the film is Becoming Mortal. The Hospice Foundation of America has taken the initiative to enable communities across the country to have viewings of this film in an effort to get people to think a little bit more about how they want to be cared for, not just right at the end of life, but how they want to be cared for with advancing chronic diseases. Do we want to be at home? Do we want to be in a hospital, in a nursing home? How much life-sustaining technology do we want or not want? Those are all really important issues to think about. And then once people have thought about this, to then communicate those wishes, not only to their family, but their healthcare providers, kind of culminate that in making a formal document, an advance directive, a living will, a healthcare power of attorney, so that their wishes for care can be best ensured. A faculty member from Brody School of Medicine, Department of Bioethics and Interdisciplinary Studies, always leads a discussion after the showing. The film will be shown at the GK Cafe, which is at 2197 East 10th Street in Greenville, and that's at 6 p.m. on September 8th. That's a Thursday evening. The film series has always been free, and there's never been a cost associated with the film series.
For more information on this nonprofit event, visit the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a happy Labor Day weekend.